Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 25, for August 31st, 2009. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm very happy to have you with me, as always. So this is my 25th show, and I'm sort of excited about that, and I appreciate you listening for this long and sticking with me. I know some of my listeners have been with me from the beginning. I especially love hearing from you and getting feedback on the shows. But when I got up to 25, I thought, you know, why not try something a little special and put together a little package that might be a little more ambitious. So that's what I did. And this time it's all about the Gamers Confab, which is my favorite thing to do on the podcast. And I get the most feedback from you. You seem to enjoy the conversations and you know some of the people in the Confab. You read their work on their own blogs, or you play their games, or you read the newspaper that they report for, whatever. And, you know, you've been pretty loud and clear with me that you like the Gamers Confabs and you hope I continue them. So I got that message, and I've got five of them for you now. So I'm going to unroll them one at a time instead of sort of putting them all together into one big fat package. I thought it might be a little bit less unwieldy and easier to listen to if I just released one conversation at a time and sort of let you digest that and then release another one. And quite frankly, it also gives me time to edit all of them. I don't have to edit them all and finish them all and release them all at once. So that's the plan. This first edition of the Gamers Confab features three guests that have been on the show before, and they're three of my favorite writers on the internet. Wes Ertelak, also known as Iroquois Plissken. He writes Versus Clueland blog. Steve Gaynor from 2K Marin. He writes the Fulbright blog and appears occasionally on the Idle Thumbs podcast. And Nels Anderson from Hothead Games and the Above 49 blog. And in the episodes to follow, you'll hear from a whole bunch of other people that I think you'll enjoy. A lot of good conversation to come. So, without further ado, here is part one of the Gamers Confab. I hope you enjoy it, and thanks for listening. Okay, I am very happy to welcome three more members of the Gamers Confab, all returning members. Mr. Nels Anderson of Hothead Games and author of Above 49, a terrific blog and well worth your time.
Thank you, Michael.
Welcome, Nels. Good to have you.
Thanks.
Mr. Wes Ertelak, also known as Iroquois Plissken on his blog Versus Clueland. And Wes is traveling long distances this weekend, and we figured out a way to squeeze him in after a red-eye flight and all kinds of other travel. So, Wes, I really appreciate you doing this.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
My pleasure, as always. And, of course, Steve Gaynor from 2K Marin and author of the Fulbright blog. And, Steve, this is, gosh, I don't know, what, have you maybe three times you've done this with me?
This is the third one, yeah.
Yeah, so always a pleasure, and I'm always grateful to have you.
No, I know thanks you're for having me.
A busy guy, too, so I appreciate it. This is good, too, because, you know, we have the newly married, the about to be married, and the when are you going to get married trio here. newly married is Nels, so big congratulations to you, Nels.
Yeah, thanks.
And about to be married is Wes, engaged to be married.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah, woo! Congratulations. And Steve, the pressure's on you now.
I don't want you to get your hopes up.
He went strangely silent there. Did you notice that? Well, welcome all three, and thanks again for joining me. As you know, I asked you to think about the year up to this point. We're past the halfway point, but I'm sort of calling it the halfway point because we obviously have this big onslaught of games coming in the last few months of this year and the first part of next year. And I asked you to think about, you know, what stood out to you in particular as notable or important a game or an idea or an issue or a person. And each of you came up with different responses. And I thought I'd just jump in right away. And Nels, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So I'm going to cheat just a little bit because I've got 1.5 things.
Okay.
I'll go with the half really, really quick. I don't want to talk about this for too long because many folks have talked about it at length. But one moment for me this year that was definitely very, very memorable thus far was when Ben Abraham proposed that folks play Far Cry 2, like, you know, the whole permanent death thing, that when you die, that's it. You know, the game's over. And so he did it. He started it first. And I think I haven't totally caught up on all my RSS stuff from my honeymoon, but I think he's still going. I was not. Him, myself, and at least one other guy, Michael McBride, out in Montreal, we all tried to do it, and I was the first out, first to the bottom. in a very shocking and kind of lame way. So, you know, most folks have played the game, but if you haven't, there's like a simple buddy system where if you die sort of in the game, someone will come and rescue you. So there's a little bit of wiggle room in Far Cry 2 like there isn't in other games, which kind of makes this a little more than just, you know, 5 minutes in, bam, you're dead. Well, there's nothing to take from that. So what happened was I lost my buddy, and then later, not long after, I was just, you know, doing nothing, just playing the game like normal. I'd gotten kind of sloppy. I was like, this isn't that hard. Then I got hit by a car and died.
Just out of nowhere.
Yeah, just out of nowhere. I was like, oh, yeah, Jeep's coming up, whatever, I can take him. And I'd kind of forgotten that if you even get touched by a vehicle with any kind of momentum, it's just instant death. But I was
that
sloppy.
Got me a few times when I was playing Far Cry 2.
Yeah,
sort of sloppy. Like just a death screen shows up, and then you see a Jeep kind of roll over your head.
Yeah, and I was playing it late after my now wife had gone to bed, and I just sat there and stared at the screen for a couple of minutes. I was like, "Wow, I guess that's it." And then I started started to think about, you know, how sometimes you can't really control things in your life, even if it's not like death, but even smaller things. And I was like, "Wait a minute, this is just a video game." But then I sort of had to sit back and scuttle that. I was like, you know, if games are supposed to be affecting, like all kinds of other media are, like this, what I, you know, this experience I'm having is totally legitimate. So I wrote about it, and Ben responded, and then Clint got into it, and Manveer, and there was a really awesome conversation that kind of emerged out of this whole thing that Ben did. I mean, you know, I was totally just remoring on his awesome experiment.
My previous podcast was. Clint Hawking was my guest.
Yes, with Clint, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, he was obviously very intrigued by that, and was he wanted to talk to Ben, and he wanted to understand what that was all about, and he, you know, obviously he found it interesting, and so, you know, Ben must have been onto something.
Yeah.
the design of the game involved. But so ultimately then, was it worth doing?
Absolutely. Like everything from the actual experience itself and then all the other stuff that kind of spun out around it. It was really, really fantastic. It's definitely something I'm going to remember. But I don't want to talk about it too much because that was like my little half thing. But I just wanted to get a shout in.
Can I ask you one question about it? Well, just while we're talking about it here.
Yeah.
So like in the debate that kind of sprung up between, you know, and I know, Steve, you talked a little bit about this too. In the debate that kind of sprung up between Steve and Manveer about this like moral choice idea in the game, it seemed that like Clint was kind of leaning towards the view that the attempt to inject like permanence and like sort of irrevocable decisions into, you know, the way we play games is just a sort of foreign way to like work with the medium, right? He kind of talked about the like a difference between like, you know, the kind of tools from cinema with a lot of like there's always like one single way through there, right? Like there's a very permanent way to approach, you know, creating a piece of media as opposed to the way that games do that are this you know, kind of inherently open-ended, you know, that like games are there for you to explore the whole possibility space. It's not about, you know, making you commit to exactly one path. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wondered, you know, I find these attempts that, right, where you kind of use these practices and the way you play the game to impose a kind of permanence on the game that isn't there in the first place, and whether or not you think that that should be part of design or you think that's something that should be permanently just part of like how we play games. Or, interesting what you take on that was.
I think that my assumption about, I don't know, I guess the way I would look at it and my read on kind of Clint's reactions to both Manveer's kind of like design imposed permanence concept and Ben's, you know, like player-driven permanence is that, and so I'll just speak from my own point of view. I think this is kind of what Clint was saying as well, was that the designer trying to artificially impose permanence is just going to chafe any player that isn't inherently on board for that experience, because it is artificial. Like, the games are not a thing that only flow in one direction, right? And so the designer saying, once you've made a decision, that decision's made forever unless you start a new game. People can just feel the yoke on their neck. But on the other side of that, the designer creating a game in which the player is free to explore multiple paths of possibility and to impose on themselves a limit of, I'm going to put a condition from my side onto this game and say, when I die, I'm dead and I have to stop. And that's going to make me play this game differently, more cautiously or attentively or more slowly or whatever. I think that designing a game where the player is able to make their experience more interesting by making their decision, that decision themselves, is more successful than designing the game where that's the only experience that you can have.
And I think the other thing is that certain types of games, just by their nature, do sort of force that designer permanence. Like, you know, all roguelikes are like that, right? Like, any decision you make in a roguelike, for all intents and purposes, is permanent because you can't ever back it up. But because you're going to be dying and that loop is so tight, the permanent decisions aren't really that bad because they're permanent, but it's only like per, you know, roguelike instance or life or whatever. And then in that case, it's a lot easier to swallow than, you know, you have a 20-hour game, you made a decision at hour 15, that's it.
Yeah. I think that one big aspect of it is whether the game has an outright failure state or not. Because you look at some games that have, like, that are not purely casual games, that have an actual nuanced design, like, you know, The Sims or Animal Crossing or something, where you can do stuff that may not be optimal and may have some kind of negative impact in the greater scheme of things, but you never die. And so I think very few people, like, quit out without saving intentionally to, like, go back and undo something. Compared to, I died in an FPS, I'm definitely going to load my game so I can get past that part. You know, like, having a softer positive negative space as opposed to just win fail, I think encourages people to just accept, I missed a day of work, and so I got fired, and I have to start a new career path, as opposed to just, I got a game over screen. I guess I'll go back to before I got fired, because getting fired is game over, and make sure I don't get fired, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's something really fun about the kind of mental exercise that goes on in your head when you save it to implement a strategy that you're not sure will work, or maybe your second or third strategy, and you know you've got that save game, so you're going to try this or that or that. And you're engaging in all kinds of different ways and thinking about it in different ways. And that's only possible if you make it possible.
Right. Yeah. It's a lot of gameplay, I think, has an analog in the scientific method, and just allowing people to put down a marker point and say, I have a theory and I'm going to go test it. And if it doesn't work out, I'll go back here and try it a little bit differently. You know, I think that's really fruitful.
Yeah. So there's your half. There's your half.
That's my half. Oh, no, that's awesome. That's awesome. It's very good. So the real thing, my real, you know, takeaway from the first half of 2008, and I wrote about this not long ago, is sort of, this isn't something new, but there seems to be more conversation, more sort of momentum growing around this. The notion that games don't have to be, quote unquote, fun. So there was that Anthony Birch, he posted this big old thing about it. There was a response from Jaffe. I wrote about it. A bunch of other stuff. But there's been a number of games that came out this year that I think very well illustrated that games don't have to be quote-unquote fun to still be a good, you know, investment of your time. One that stands out very explicitly is The Path. It seems weird to call that game fun because it's very dark. It's very slow. It's, you know, almost Lynchian in like how it's presented and what it's trying to do. But it's not like it's a waste of your time. It's, you know, I very much enjoyed it. Like I felt like that was, you know, a worthwhile thing to do, but it seemed weird. And it still seems weird to call that fun. And there were several other Half-Life mods specifically that came out this year. Dear Esther, the Radiator games that have that very similar notion where this is good. This is a good use of my time. It's not really fun.
Yeah. It's interesting, right?
Yeah. What is it then? If it's not fun, what is it instead?
Yeah. So what I call it is engaging. The particular term you need to use, it doesn't really matter. The whole point really of this sort of don't call, we shouldn't call games fun as much as we do, is that for a lot of people, the term fun has a lot of contextual baggage, especially people that aren't core gamers. Like, you know, Raf Kosser wrote about it in his book, like, you know, his theory of fun for games design. Fun for him and the fun in games comes from understanding systems, interacting with them, applying them, and all that kind of stuff. But for people who don't play a lot of games, that's not what fun means to them. For most folks that aren't core gamers, fun is, you know, a diversion. It's a shallow thing. Perhaps it's a childlike thing. But it's not, you know, a quality that, like, deep, enriching media has. Like, Hamlet, that's not, most people wouldn't call that fun. But it's not a waste of their time. I'm just saying that, and of course, I mean, the truth is that most games aren't fun in the shallow sense of fun. Right? Like, you know, getting sniped halfway across the map when you're playing Team Fortress 2, it's not really fun, but the overall experience, that is certainly enjoyable. And so there have been lots of, like, micro instances of that, but this year specifically saw lots of really big macro instances of things we can point at. We can say, it seems weird to call this thing fun, but it's still engaging. It's still a very good use of my time. We can do all kinds of things like this. And, you know, it's not a waste, because lots of people with the, when you say, you know, games shouldn't be fun, they're like, well, if they're not fun, then that means they suck. You know, why should we make crappy games? It's like, we don't mean the shallow fun. You know, games just don't have to be like shallow bubblegum and, you know, punch and pie fun. They're still engaging. And I think that's just the distinction I'm trying to make. It seems semantic, but I think it is actually a real distinction that's kind of important to note. And hopefully, as more people sort of realize that the primary payoff for games is engagement, and whether or not that is a synonym for fun is whatever, then we can drive more experiences and designs towards things that are just engaging, but not necessarily shallow fun.
Well, let me ask you, Nils, do you think that the examples you've cited from this year have been successful as deep engagement? Like, because you talk about shallow fun and... The impression I get is that while I did enjoy The Path and I got hung up on Dear Esther, they seemed shallow in a different way to me. What do you think?
So shallow how?
Shallow experientially, right? Like, I enjoyed them, but both of those games at least were essentially three-dimensional spaces to hold just static media, like walk into a trigger and an authored piece of content appears,
right?
You know, and it's not fun the way that God of War is fun, but it's not deep the way that exploring the system space of Deus Ex is deep. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm not like, yeah, there are definitely two sort of axes here. It's just good that, you know, we can, that's what I really would like to recognize, is that there are indeed, you know, there's how there's the sort of the depths of the systems and how much fun that is to interact. And then there's is this sort of like amusing, or is, you know, does it provoke some other kinds of emotions? And I'd actually point to the Radiator mods being a bit better in terms of not just being a space where stuff sits. And then when you get close to it, it plays.
Yeah. What are the Radiator? I mean, yeah, I haven't heard of them.
There are just a couple of Half-Life 2 mods. The first one is really short. It is kind of linear, and it hit me in kind of a personal way, so other people might not approach it the same way. But the second one is deeply surreal, and I don't want to try to describe it too much, because that might sort of, you know, point your vision one way or the other.
Sure.
But it seemed to do better with actually having this more substantive thing to interact with. That so it had like that deep, more, I mean, obviously, you know, it's only like a half hour, 45 minute mod. So,
oh, right. I just clicked on these on my internet, and I do remember seeing a link to at least one of them from Rock, Paper, Shotgun. Like, the first one, or the second one, I guess, one of them, you're, like, in a psychiatrist's office, at least at one point in it, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
kind of.
Well, and anyway, that's how they put the front on it. So, I mean, that's an interesting situation to put the player in a Half-Life mod, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that was sort of in stark contrast to another awesome mod that came out this year called Research and Development, which was, it totally had that, like, more of that systems depth. Like, you know, it was basically just a mod that was entirely awesome Half-Life style physics puzzles. But it was still that sort of more moment-to-moment fun. Like, it wasn't, you know, didn't have any sort of deep themes or speak to the human condition, but it was awesome. And I'm really glad that things like that exist. So when I say, you know, games don't necessarily have to be fun in sort of the shallow amusement sense, it doesn't mean they can't be. Like, most of them probably will be because that's awesome. Yeah. It's just that by necessity, they don't have to be. And more stuff this year has really pointed at that successfully in, you know, a broad scope, is that folks were intentionally attempting to make these kinds of experiences. And obviously there's a lot to learn there to make these things interesting and deep and not just boring.
Yeah. I guess my question for you is, or just the thing I think of here is, what do you think the real distinction is, you know, like, do, because at least in, again, not having played the Radiator mods that we're talking about at the tail end here, but with the other stuff, it seems like they've achieved, like, they've combined more serious or sober content with stripped down systems, so that you can't just kind of like spaz out and do the fun video game thing. I mean, what is the distinction between a shallow fun game and a more serious game, if not that you just don't have as much agency, you know, because you can break a serious mood easily if you have a whole lot of agency, you know, like if something super serious is going on and then you have a jump button so you can jump up on top
jump
of
on the
super
table.
Serious guy's head or whatever. Like,
right.
I mean, that's the most simple example, but I guess I just wonder where these things are pointing to. I mean, sorry. I'm not trying to. I don't have big answers. It raises questions for me.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at the path, and maybe you could expand on this a little bit. Well, all three of you, the path is clearly there's a soberness to it, and there's a seriousness to it. But what could have been done differently? I mean, if what's missing from that? If it's sober, but not a lot more than sober, or it's sort of psychologically provocative, which I think it is. What could you do to it? What could you add to that experience that would get it beyond that or make it more than that?
I guess my feeling, the thing that pops to mind when you ask that question is that, you know, the path was essentially a number of episodic linear point-and-click adventure games with, you know, even a stripped-down interface from that, where you don't have different verbs. You just trigger hotspots to eventually find the way to complete the episode. But it always plays out the same way, if I'm not mistaken. So maybe the next step for the path to engage the player more, like give the player a reason to be there, would be if you could have different outcomes that, you know, were parallel to one another based on how or in what order you interacted with the stuff in the world, you know, because each episode did have two outcomes. One was just walk straight down the path to the end and you skipped all the content, or the other one is just hit the right hotspots in the right order to end it the other way. But maybe if the different stuff in the world actually had properties that the player could read and figure out and be like, oh, if I combine this with this instead of the other way, it'll have some outcome that I can try to predict and feel clever about, or feel like I'm actually impacting the world by being here without putting a bunch of, you know, crazy action gameplay in it or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, when David Jaffe responded to Anthony Birch, who talked about this stuff, his response was actually a lot more cogent than I was kind of expecting. Which is cool. But he said that, you know, lots of people pitch this stuff, but nearly all of it is ridiculously boring. And I think he's probably right. You know, the sort of the examples I've cited and the other things that kind of point in this direction, they're all very short experiences. And while that does contribute probably to their shallowness, I think they're also short just because we don't know how to make these types of things interesting and engaging for 10 hours.
Yeah.
Because obviously, like, more twitchy action, you know, that kind of stuff, it's easy to make that you know, we've been doing that for like 30 bloody years. Like we know how to get that to carry. Well, sometimes it doesn't happen, but in good games, at least we still know how to carry that stuff for 10, 20 hours. Yeah. And I think one of the things that I'm really excited about people trying to figure out is how to have these more sober, aesthetic games that still continue to be engaging over a long period of time. Or maybe they don't have to be. You know, maybe it's all right if the more sober games are like 2 hours at the longest. Maybe that's fine. I'm not sure there's a problem with that. I guess sort of related to that, there's and this has been happening for years, but there is a growing notion that shorter games are fine. And maybe one of the things that was kind of holding this back is, you know, well, if every game has to be 40 hours, it has to be fun because we can't make, you know, a 40-hour game kind of sober and meditative. And now that short games are fine, that might facilitate this quite a bit more as well.
Mm-hmm. Wes, were you going to say something a second ago? I thought.
Yeah, I mean, this is just kind of like my thought on the whole conversation. But it seems to me that, you know, there's more than one type of kind of satisfaction that you can be after with like a video game. And it seems that we've really pinned down really well a certain set of way of setting up mechanics in order to produce this kind of minute to minute, you know, very, I don't know what's the word for it, but like, you know, sort of fun experience, right? This is a very type of like, you know, direct constant engagement that you can sustain over a relatively long period of time. And there's other types of satisfaction that you can get from like a piece of entertainment aside from that type of like minute to minute excitement, right? And it seems to me that one of the really important ways that games are fun are the things that Steve was talking about earlier, was this kind of way of experimenting with them, like the almost type of like scientific experiment that you can do with like a possibility space. Like that's a type of, it seems to me, a type of satisfaction that is not this, that's not the type of fun, right? And then like the kind of enjoyment that you get out of it is almost like the enjoyment of like solving a difficult puzzle or like reasoning through a difficult problem. And it seems to me there's like a very distinct and like powerful type of satisfaction that you get from that. And that's something that games can do really well because of the way that, you know, they're coded and the type of media they are. So if you could integrate that type of satisfaction with, I think, the type of sober and serious approach to the subject matter that you see in games like The Path, if you were to marry those together, I think that would be something that would be very powerful.
I think that the jargon term that I think you're describing is just a core loop, and action games have a very tight core loop, going back all the way to whatever. I mean, Space Invaders, you know, where it's just like aim, fire, did I hit the target or not? Yes, no. If no, aim and fire again. You know, and you have a very quick loop of, I have a challenge, I do things that I understand to address it, and now it's been resolved, and I feel satisfaction from that. And I think that, yeah, what you're describing is sort of games that aren't about the stuff that is easy for us and that we're used to are still searching for what their core loop to keep people engaged minute to minute is. Yeah. And yeah, that's a really tough problem. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people are working on it, which is great.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. I'm kind of thinking out loud. Sorry, we should probably move on to someone else's, but just at the last moment, I'm kind of thinking out loud here, but it seems that as that you know, that core loop grows larger and longer, the games become less personal. Like games like Civ or, you know, SimCity, even like Heroes of Might and Magic, like that, obviously that sort of core loop is much, much larger, but they're not just about like a single character or a single story. They tend to be more abstract. They're certainly more broad. And maybe that correlates. Maybe it's coincidence.
Well, I'm expecting that the solutions will be found in BioShock 2 and Deathspank.
Don't make me feel sad.
Wes, why don't we toss it over to you? What's your game, person, issue, theme, controversy of the year?
I guess for me it's an issue, and I don't know. This is kind of an issue that's just been, I've been thinking about it this year, and I've been thinking about also as we move into the, you know, the fall season, is that like I think I have like just a real bad case of something that I think is pretty endemic in video games, which is this sense of sequel fatigue, where
Sorry.
I feel it's bad, it's real bad, and the thing is, it's not just like the sort of standard problem that we complain about in video games, where it's that, you know, a particular series you know, there's all these numbered, you know, elements of a particular series, but this sort of like wider sense that if you're playing a certain genre or you're playing a certain type of game, you're also at the same time, much more than like in the parallel cases in cinema, you're playing like the same research program as all these other games that are in the same genre, right? So you can see being a game with new characters and a new environment and all this stuff, and you're playing through it and you're like, I played this game before. I played, you know, this feels so much like the 1.68 of third person action game, you know. and I think, you know, on one hand, this seems to be almost a natural way for games to be developed. Like, it, from what I know of, or about game design, it is, you know, intrinsically, I don't know, have you guys read, Chris Dolan wrote an article last December, I think it was, called Games Are Software.
Right. Yep. I love that article.
And I really love that article, but I think about it a lot when I think about one of the things that I have a problem with games, right, which is that the experience itself can feel very iterative, right? When you're sitting down and holding that controller, it can be a new game that is not like a numbered sequel, but it can feel very distinctly like you're playing an iteration on a particular design path. And on one hand, I love the way that like that's how games become good, right? That's how games get better. But on the other hand, you know, I'm struck down by this feeling that there, you know, you pick up a game and it seems that at least this year, there hasn't been much that really felt like, you know, there was something new under the sun. You know, there were a lot of like really enjoyable, fun games, and this may just be, you know, a faction of the games that I've played as opposed to the things that you guys have played. But very few things that have just sort of, you know, upon first, you know, putting them in your hands and playing them again, really just felt new. And it's just kind of it's dispiriting.
Yeah, I think something that I've noticed, and that, I mean, maybe it's obvious, is that it feels like a lot of times that is the distinction between a game that maybe some people like or that scores well in the reviews and one that becomes, you know, whatever, game of the year fodder or stuff that people are still talking about the following year or, you know, years later, is that it feels like it establishes a new genre or a new subgenre, or it isn't, you know, as you said, Half-Life 2, but with a different setting, you know, like at its base, or God of War, but with different character, etc. I mean, those are the games that I think that the two sides of the equation are, one, those are the kinds of people, those are kind of games that really get people's attention and that become, you know, sort of, at least for gamers, the household name games that get mentioned all the time by people in the press and Penny Arcade and everything. On the other side, just from a practical publishing standpoint, they're a lot of times the riskiest kind of game to fund, because if it is totally different but it doesn't catch on, then you probably failed. And it's safer to say, hey, don't you like Call of Duty? We're making our version of Call of Duty. You're going to like that too, you know.
And to be fair, also, I want to say that also, you know, going back to the software point, it seems to be almost intrinsic to the medium that like the first try with something that introduces like a new set of mechanics or like a very fresh new sort of idea tends to be kind of a failure, right? Like when I think of games like last year that tried to do this, like Mirror's Edge isn't like a whole scale, you know, work of innovation, but I felt it was really trying to do something new. And it was a failure as a game, you know, just because there were all these other elements of the sort of recipe that were going in there that hadn't quite gelled correctly. Mm-hmm. And you know that if they go out and make another one of those games and make the, you know, want them to cry here, they go out and make a sequel, that formula will be better than it was the first time, right? And I can think of like tons of parallels where, you know, people say this about like Assassin's Creed, people say this, you know, about Uncharted, games that I both thought were very interesting in a lot of the things that they did, but, you know, will, I think, almost like objectively be better by being made again and having their systems kind of iterated on and people thinking about what are the problems in the first one. But sort of the drawback of that is, right, is that like all the other games, you know, and maybe this is just a function. Did anyone play any games like the first, I guess now, almost 8 months of the year where they really did feel like there was something new and exciting going on in there? Because I felt there were precious few.
I mean, I'm excited about the Batman right now. It has a number of features that feel legitimately new and innovative, or are otherwise just done better or more appropriately or more effectively than I've ever seen them done before. with a mix of other features that are clearly appropriated from established games, but in a way that serves their whole design really well. It stands out as feeling like an actual fresh, really well-considered game design as a whole, in a way that, you know, games that, that you're describing as, you know, or that we all know of as just takeoffs of something that's established, don't feel that way.
But it's it sounds like your description of it, though, it's because it's solid, because it's very solid. It's well done. It's well executed. That, thinking back to last year or a little before that, there was the BioShock moment. You know, we were all talking about BioShock. There was the Fallout 3 moment, and Far Cry 2 had that for a time, and there has been no such moment this year. I mean, in some ways, the most interesting conversations have been more sort of meta conversations about, you know, whether or not you should buy Shadow Complex, and what does that mean if you put money down for that game. That's actually an interesting conversation with some depth to it. But that kind of depth or that kind of interesting conversation, it seems to me, hasn't really happened around a game.
Maybe not. I mean, the thing about BioShock even is that BioShock is a good example of the iterative approach, in that, you know, early on it was announced publicly that it was to be a spiritual successor to System Shock 2, which for a certain niche of players was a very successful design, and it scored well, but it didn't set the world on fire. And obviously, BioShock changed a lot from the core System Shock 2 design, but it also started there in a lot of ways. And so even though the face was different and many, many of the mechanics and the overall feel of the game was different, it didn't just appear out of thin air itself. It wasn't System Shock 3, but it was just another example of, we tried something, we're going to take that into consideration and adjust it and try it again and differently. And in the case of BioShock, it felt completely new because few enough people had played the original game, and it had changed so much. But yeah, almost no game is just appears by spontaneous generation and is amazing and is, you know, just sort of a completely unique snowflake.
I mean, and this could be kind of a natural progression too. Like, the games where we notice these sort of major steps forward the most are obvious, are really, really big games, right? And just the way, you know, various cycles and everything work out, it could be that the effects from, like, the BioShocks and the Fallout 2s, we might see those in, like, another year or two. But I did, like, I played a decent handful of games this year that were all much smaller games, which is probably why there wasn't just as much conversation about them, that I felt were, like, a pretty substantive move forward. Again, not like, you know, from the sky something brand new, but just the level of refinement in things like Trine and Yet It Moves, and even Little King Story, like, those were all, I thought at least, in a lot of ways, like, pretty substantive steps forward, but because they just didn't have, you know, the marketing or just the conversation, the public attention, maybe they were less accessible, that they don't get the kind of notice that BioShocks and stuff like that do. And that's fine. I mean, but maybe it's just kind of an explanation for the thing you're observing, Wes.
Yeah. I mean, and also, I mean, not to take this too long, but going into the fall, again, it seems that there just seem to be a lot of games that, you know, I know Mikey wrote about this before E3, that are just very clearly, you know, refinements upon a formula, right? And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Refinements on the formula are often more fun than the previous iterations of that formula. So...
Well, one upside of this, in a way, I guess actually I have Steve to thank for this, is you can, when you're not in the middle of that big game that everyone's talking about, you can go back and look at things you didn't pay attention to enough. And, you know, a game like The Darkness, with I think a lot of people just missed, you know, you can get a little bit of a resurrection moment, you know, where you can go back and look at a game. Or, you know, for some odd reason, have you noticed that a lot of people started playing Mass Effect recently again?
Yeah,
and writing about it and bringing up different sort of ways of thinking about the game in their writing, that there's a kind of a critical revisiting that's possible, which I think is a good sign. I mean, this let's talk about it for 3 days and move on to the next thing phenomenon is so much a part of the culture that, I don't know, it's cool to look back. It's cool to...
Yeah. I mean, my expectation is that a lot of... Yeah, I guess, as you were saying, that Were you kind of saying that's an upside of the sequel culture? Just that Mass Effect 2 is in people's minds, so it gives people a reason to go back and re-examine Mass Effect 1?
Yeah, and and that there's even a game like The Darkness, you know, that if you care about such things, that it connects to other things, and that designers that worked on that worked on something else, and that these are interesting things that probably your average gamers don't think about, but in terms of the critical reception that we have to games and the critical kind of dialogue, that we've reached the point where games are hardy enough to withstand that kind of rigorous analysis, even if a structural analysis, you know.
Yeah, I think that's right. I played a bunch of old stuff this year too. Like I finally got around to playing Burnout Paradise, played Mother 3, went back and played both the Monkey Island games, and a bunch of independent stuff. So I didn't like consciously think about it until this point, but maybe I too was feeling the same thing you were describing, Wes, and I just compensated it by playing a bunch of old games, a bunch of indie games and stuff like that. So I didn't notice it as much.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what I like about lulls in big game releases, or kind of stuff that really does blow you away, is it gives, sort of writers at large, and then yourself as well, a chance to think about, oh yeah, there was this game I missed, or maybe in the last deluge of games there was some game that, you know, sounded interesting but got an 81 so I didn't buy it, or and now I'll give that a chance. I mean, in the early summer lull for me, I took the chance to finally, after many tries over many years, get really deeply into the original System Shock 1, and that was probably my most memorable gaming experience this year so far.
Well, why don't we toss it to you, Steve? What's your game, person,
thing. Person, place, or thing.
I'm tired of repeating that, so I'll just say, let's toss it to you, Steve.
Looking at just the stuff that's gotten coverage online, and that I've seen people mention, and that has personal relevance to me, is that it seems like this game, this year more than most, we've been hit by a big, big wave of big name games getting delayed until the following year, like so much so that people have really mentioned, like, oh wait, almost nothing's coming out at Christmas this year because so much stuff is getting pushed. I polled my Twitter people to remind me of stuff that got delayed. The list that I got back from people was, you know, Mass Effect 2, Bayonetta, Splinter Cell Conviction, MAG, massive action game for the PlayStation, Mafia 2, Dark Void, Dante's Inferno, Red Dead Redemption, Singularity, Red Steel 2. As you can see, there's a lot that people were thinking were going to come out, and they're getting pushed back. And I guess, I mean, I have a take or two on sort of what that means for how we make games and how we how fans of games kind of interact with them pre-release and what their expectations are and stuff. But I don't know. I wonder if you guys had noticed this or if it felt significant to you in 2009 compared to prior years.
Yeah, definitely. To me, I look forward to certain games. And I don't know why I get like this, but I get myself very excited about something, and the release date actually means something to me, that I think about that date, and I'll even occasionally put a date on a calendar if it's a game I'm really excited about. And yeah, I mean, I admit I'm casual enough or whatever, or mainstream enough to say, I get disappointed when I see on Kotaku that a game isn't going to come out for another 3 or 6 months or whatever. I always find it disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe.
I'm going to take the opposite take, at least about the winter release schedule. You know, on one hand, it's disappointing. Yeah, I think what Mike is talking about is totally right. But on the other hand, I just remember as someone who, you know, likes to think about and play games and likes to kind of like, you know, be online and read what people are saying, the fact that fewer things are coming out in the fourth fiscal quarter is kind of a massive blessing to all of us. I mean, I still got Fable 2 sitting in my thing in the shrink wrap from when I got it last December, as unplayed now as it was then, you know. So, and I also feel like there was a year, I think, it was 2008, right, where Metal Gear Solid 4 and Grand Theft Auto both came out in, like, April or May.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like this intense devotion towards laying everything out during a certain part of the calendar year is kind of crazy. I mean, I guess it's mm-hmm. understandable, and there's lots of parallels in other industries, but I feel like as someone who just likes to play games, Christmas in April is great, you know, and that great game that you've been looking forward to, and you know that it will be better in April than it will be, you know, in December, and it, you know, it's going to still be there. You know, I'm usually happy about that. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of noticed just, you know, there's lots of, you know, there's another post on Gamma Sutra of blah, blah, blah has been delayed. But I don't really find it affecting. I actually feel it largely the same way Wes does, because now there is perhaps some tiny hope of clearing out this massive list of two plays in my gaming backlog. As long as spring 2010 isn't the next Christmas 08, right. I'm totally happy.
From a player's perspective, yeah, I think it's wonderful to have games spread out over the year. So, you know, you're not deciding between six games in 1 month. There's one or two games maybe each month, if you're lucky, that come out that you actually really want to play, and that's cool. From the development side, that's where it really strikes me is, you know, between all the layoffs of the prior year and early this year, that we're still reading about in Gamma Sutra articles weekly or monthly, and the fact that there were all of these big name games, like a dozen or you know however many I just named off, big name games slated for this year that are slipping, that clearly at one point somebody expected them to get finished. I think that the whole phenomenon is kind of bringing into question the way that big publishers make big AAA games. Between, you know, the economy being good and studios and publishers staffing up and having hundreds and hundreds of people on a single game, and having all that risk because, you know, you're paying so many salaries and you're making this giant thing and you have to sell however many tens of millions of copies to make your money back. And the fact that, you know, there were a bunch of those kinds of propositions expected for this year, and you know, all across the board, people just couldn't swing it. It seems like maybe this is the kind, you know, these are not positive things that, you know, people's financials are slipping and the people don't have their jobs and stuff. But kind of, you know, to the point that we started on, Nels, about shorter and smaller games and everything, I wonder if in the great scheme of things, it's not positive that we're seeing that sort of the big bloated must be a blockbuster culture of AAA game development is kind of hitting some speed bumps with the economy the way it is and everything. I'm hoping that it might just lead to you know, a little bit more realistic expectations for the kinds of games that we're going to make and the kind of games that people want to buy, and that maybe it'll give us some opportunities for smaller, more focused, you know, less crowd pleaser, mainstream, big explosion kind of stuff. Just because obviously on one side, it's getting hard for publishers to, you know, pay and sustain the development of these things. And on the other, you know, they're not getting out to market the way that they thought they were going to be able to.
Well, what do you think about Molyneux and Lionhead's strategy, or I guess maybe it's Microsoft's strategy, with Fable 2, of taking what is a big game and chopping it up into pieces and releasing it almost like an episodic or subscription model?
You mean like the thing that they announced for Fable 3?
Are they doing that for Fable 3? I thought they were sort of re-releasing Fable 2 in that model.
That's what I thought.
Oh, okay. I hadn't followed it closely.
But you've sort of leaped where I was going to leap. That what if that's how you did a game that hadn't yet come out? They're basically trying to encourage people who didn't buy Fable 2. Here's a way you can get in for cheap, and if you don't like it, then just stop buying it, and you don't have to play the rest of the game. But, you know, what if that was the model for the game from the beginning? Is that a viable thing, do you think? Would anybody be interested in that?
I don't want to speak for more than just myself, but episodic games are a lot harder to do than people think.
I think you have some expertise on that issue, right?
That's all I'm saying. Maybe the expectations would be different if it was someone like Microsoft who could, you know, throw a bajillion dollars and all kinds of polish and all that stuff at it. But one of the problems, the expectation problem a lot of people had with episodic games, and you even saw this with like Telltale's games, and they're hands down the most successful episodic folks, is between episode one and episode two, people want something different. It's like, well, they came out a month apart. You know, you get these reviews that are like, well, the formula is sure starting to show. Like, they came out like 3 weeks from each other. Like, what do you expect?
Yeah.
And yeah. Like, so that is a very real problem. But could someone like Microsoft with, you know, a bottomless well of money be able to solve that? They might be able to. But back to what Steve was saying in general, if sort of the delays and all this stuff did kind of shake up how we look at AAA development, like, that would be fantastic. Again, I mean, I don't work for a AAA developer, so I can't speak to it at the same degree. But this is kind of the thing that, in our space, we try to do, right? Like, we want to make shorter games that take less time, take less money, and are very respectful of the player's level of investment. That, you know, as folks get, as like core gamers like me and all you guys get older and start getting families and all that stuff, that the amount of time you have decreases, right? Like, I can't, like, I hear a game has 80 hours of gameplay, and I'm like, well, God, I don't want to play that because that's the only game I'm going to play this year then,
right?
Maybe. If sort of AAA games kind of pulled back a little bit, not just in length, but in terms of like budget and expectations and the way they're built and all that, like, that would be fantastic. Hopefully that can happen without the bunch of people losing their jobs and all that, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think just in general, if the sort of the ecosystem of development moved away from these very large publishers having to like kind of stack all their chips onto certain games, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if that particular sort of model were maybe to shuffle off, because it seems like the more chips you shuffle onto a particular game, the more you invest in it, the less sort of creative freedom I think you sometimes have with it, right? Like, you're really stuck with having to not take bets on that thing. And I think to the extent that they, you know, we move away from that model, maybe we'll see more games that can take more risks. Right?
Yeah. And it's not just the publishers either, right? Like, if you're, you know, the creative director of some studio that's working on a $30 million game for Activision, like, you probably aren't going to want to be risky just because you don't want to, you know, lay off 300 people who, you know, who work for you and who are all awesome people. And it's not just, you know, we have to make the most money. It's, you don't want to tell these people, okay, guys, you got to find a new way to feed your family.
Yeah, those people's jobs are your responsibility if you're in that role, right? And so the trade-off against taking risks, you know, you can't say, like, oh, you know. So
something that you said, Nels, I think lines up with something I've thought in the past is that, you know, taking big games and splitting them up and releasing them episodically, you know, my initial thought was like, well, then doesn't that impact your ability to create a game where a system kind of spans the entire experience? But, like, I don't really think so, because even the biggest open world game, aside from like something that isn't even avatar based, something like Civilization or whatever, where obviously that's more like a board game and you would have to release that as a single piece. But the stuff that we think of as big AAA games, you experience them episodically, you know, in a way. Like, maybe not Fallout 3, right? Like, Fallout 3 is as big of an open world as a AAA game gets. But when you scale back from there to any semi-linear game you want to look at, whether it's a Half-Life game or a Bioshock game, or even like Grand Theft Auto, it's been interesting me to think of how a game like that is, I think the closest analog is like a season of a television show, where each level is kind of an episode of a TV show, where you might get kind of tidbits of the A storyline throughout each level. You know, like if it's a season of Mad Men or whatever, you'll find out a little bit more about Don Draper and you know, his marriage or whatever in each level. But then they also have a self-contained thing, you know, where maybe one of the junior guys has some kind of wacky thing that gets resolved within that episode. And video game levels or just like, you know, the self-contained quests, or, you know, whatever, yeah, I guess I'll say quest lines in GTA where you have like one guy who gives you six missions or whatever. Those already feel like a thing that, much like a TV episode, contributes to a whole but is self-contained. And really, you know, if you had a viable production model for doing that, you know, where you don't just have to build a giant AAA game all at once and then release it in chunks, because I don't know if there would actually be any advantage to that. Yeah. The games we play already seem set up conceptually to be episodic, even though we don't sell them that way.
So yeah, like you're saying, some really, really do. And I think, like, looking at games as, you know, a complex TV series is actually far more productive than looking at them as films.
For sure. Yep.
Yeah, and there's pretty much more good stuff on TV these days than there are at the movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, well, actually, and the thing is that, especially with Netflix, you know, people love to sit down and watch a whole TV series. You know, maybe you get really into it and you watch four episodes or five episodes a day, like for you know, a few days and just blaze through it. Or maybe you watch a couple episodes a week, you know, and there are people that play games that way too. I think the big thing about television, and this only kind of came about in the age of DVD, is that they have a really good distribution model for we'll produce episodes in a linear order and start airing them while we're still producing the rest of the season. And if it's not getting any ratings, it can be canceled so the you know, production company can cut their losses or whatever. And then if it's successful, the people who are really devoted will watch every episode as it comes out. And the people that hear that it's cool after the fact can just buy the box set and watch it all or get individual episodes from Netflix and see if they like it. Like, there's just so many different ways to sample and try it and for them basically to get your money that games don't really have and that I think we're still looking for. Yeah. And I think that we're starting, you know, between digital distribution and various forms of retail, people are starting to find ways to open up how we make games and how they're sold.
Yeah. I think this television analogy is interesting. I agree. This is an interesting kind of, if we were to go down this road, if it went in a certain way, it could be useful and positive. But I know the downside to me is television would love to have blockbusters. Television would the industry, I would think, still envies movies in this way, in this one way, that you can have that event that is huge and that everyone's pointing at, and that it's that AAA title that's coming out that everyone buys. It's Halo.
Yeah.
And that we wouldn't.
Don't you think that TV has that, though? I mean, between, what the fuck is it called? The singing show.
Oh, yeah,
American Idol.
Yeah, between American Idol and, like, Lost, you know, and sort of the water cooler shows that, you know, it's like, oh, man, the finale's on or whatever. Like, I think there are some examples of that in sort of the mainstream network television space.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe I'm thinking about it differently. I'm thinking of the box office bonanza film that opens huge and that drives tons of traffic to the movie theater, and that there's a moment that occurs that feels to me different and bigger than the television moments that occur.
Because it really is like a single event. It's not, this thing has been building for, you know, like, the entire summer, and while the finale is huge, it's not huge in the way that, like, the opening of Return of the King was huge or something like that.
Right, yeah. When Batman comes out, when of course, I think the video game analogies are, the video game side of it's even more compelling, that a Halo game, when it hits, when a GTA game, when it hits, that is a big, big event, and it needs to be a big event. If those stop being big events, I don't know. It seems to me that we may take a little bit of a step backward. We need at least a few moments with video games where everyone's pointing at them and they're on the covers of magazines and, you know, it's a big deal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to kind of tie stuff in, one, I don't think those single big games, I don't think it's ever going to go away. And to what Wes was saying, maybe it's going to be the case that the games that are more iterative, that are like super, super polished versions of stuff that has come before, maybe those will continue to be the super big, you know, movie mega blockbuster style opening games. And the stuff that's more experimental, that's a little bit different, that may not have as much of a larger audience, that can be more of a TV series episodic style thing. Mm. And that could work. I mean, I think that, you know, both could be sustainable just for different types of things.
Yeah. Well, we've run to the end of our time. Did I leap over anybody's remark or comment?
No.
Cool.
It was very awesome.
Well, I want to thank all three of you. You guys are just wonderful, and I love you guys. Love talking with you guys. I'm hoping that we can do a little GDC reunion maybe next time.
Yeah, it'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, Mr. Nels Anderson from Hothead Games, Above 49 is his blog. Wes Ertelak from Versus Clueland. And Wes, you're moving and everything. Is Versus Clueland on a little bit of a hiatus at this point?
Yeah, I'm attempting to write a dissertation, but I want to get back to it.
Whatever.
I know.
And Steve Gaynor from 2K Marin and the Fulbright blog. And both Nels and Steve, good luck on your work, too. I know you guys are working
good
hard
luck, guys.
On games. So.
Oh, yeah. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Great.
Yeah, thanks.
Take care, fellas.
It's been a lot of
fun.
Thank you, Michael. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Cheers.